with that of the life of the Prophet Muhammad. These are his dialogues.
قال الإمام الكاظم عليه السلام: إن أصبركم على البلاء لأزهدكم في الدنيا.
Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salam stated, "Verily, he who is most persevering in the face of adversity is the most abstemious from among you."
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's great to have you with us. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. Dear friends, when we're talking about the beautiful dialogues of Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam, this divinely appointed Imam from the household of the Holy Prophet, peace and blessings upon him and his holy household, we find that Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam talked about affection and being considerate and kind to people. It is interesting, we find that the infallible and immaculate Imams, they really spoke about everything that you could imagine, whether it was the regular sciences or whether it was the spiritual sciences or religious sciences such as fiqh and jurisprudence and political, cultural, societal, individual matters. It is very amazing to see how these individuals and these Imams, of course, whose source of knowledge is the Almighty Allah, have such a vast array of knowledge and wisdom. It's really amazing and mind-boggling. And here, in response to showing affection and kindness towards people, when Imam al-Kadhim was talking with his companion, we find that Imam al-Kadhim says to him, showing affection to people is half of intellect. Now, of course, here, you know, we might think that intellect, aql, rationality or logic or this kind of computerized decision-making process, but this intellect, half of it is being kind and showing affection and being considerate to people. So Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam here in this conversation with his companion is really telling us that if you are a person who has a high level of intellect, a person who has a high level of rationality and logic, if we want to call aql that as well, but an individual who has intelligence and who has this, again, high level of intellect, then the proof that they have a high level of intellect is that they show affection and they are considerate and they are kind towards people. It's interesting. In this very materialistic and temporal way of thinking that some of us are afflicted with, we think that a high level of intellect means, you know, I don't know, like they're a doctor or an engineer or they're some kind of savvy politician or they can solve the problems of the world. Perhaps this is the other half of intellect, but at least one half of intellect in reality, as Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam says, is showing affection to people. So if we have an individual who we believe or we imagine has a high level of intellect, but they do not show affection to people, then truly this means that they don't have half of their intellect. They are something else. They're not an intellectual. And what a beautiful way to describe intellect and what a beautiful way to show the signs of true intellect, as Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam has done by saying that half of intellect, 50% of intellect and aql, and this logic and rationality is showing affection, kindness, and consideration towards people. This is dialogue, Imam Al-Kadhim, alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Now let's listen to Brother Muhammad Al-Hilli, who's going to talk about today's topic.
When it comes to the analysis of the life of the Imam, one begins to understand that there were a number of challenges that were posed in his lifetime. What kind of challenges? He went through 5 Abbasid caliphs. Who were they? As-Saffah, Al-Mansur, Al-Hadi, Al-Mahdi, and finally Harun al-Abbasi. And during each and every caliphate of these particular 5 tyrants, the Imam Salamullahi Alayhi adopted a number of strategies and became very much influential within the community and within the Muslim Ummah. One thing that the Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kadhim, Salawatullahi wa Salamu Alayhi, was very much distinguished at the onset was the fact that he wanted to purify the intentions as well as correct some of the moral indecencies that were prevalent within the society at that time. In which way? Imam alayhi salam would walk past a house in which music is being played. A servant outside is bringing the rubbish or the garbage. He asks her, the owner of the house that the music inside is being played, is he a slave or is he a master? She responds back by saying, indeed, he is a master. Imam alayhi salam would say to her, if he was a slave, he would have respected his master. And he moves on. The lady goes back. The man inside by the name of Bishr says to her, who did you speak to? She describes this man that she saw. She says he has thafanat. Thafanat means excess skin on his forehead. She says to him that he was so skinny when he was standing, I could see the wind somewhat moving his body and his aba. He immediately recognizes that this is a noble individual, a virtuous man. Tell me, what is it that he said? She responds back by saying that he said, if the man inside the house was a slave, he would have respected his master. That statement hit hard in the heart of this man, Bishr, who runs barefooted to catch Imam Musa ibn Ja'far and says to him, Sayyidi wa Mawlai, halli min tawbah.
Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to visit our website at farstoday.com/en, Call of Islam page, where you can find all of our previous programs and many others as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters 11,865 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
Self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamate is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hujjatul Islam Husseini Qumi. Stay tuned.
که ما الان روزی چند ساعت سرمون تو این مسائل چی به سلولای مغزمون داریم تحویل میدیم چیزی میمونه دیگه بر سلول مغز
How many hours during a day we spend our time about the fake news of here and there? What do we add to our knowledge by this news? Nothing but distraction from the right path. The late Allama Jafari and scholars like him didn't have even their phone numbers and sometimes the exact addresses of their houses in their minds. But they had the records of more than 1,000 books with references in their memory. Why? Because they preferred to place good inputs in their brains and didn't make their minds busy with trivial points.
الا
الان در ایران ما کسی به اندازه آیت الله شوبری زنجانی تو این علم تبحر نداره. خیلی ایشون تبحر داره.
A very good example in today's life of a person who has a sharp memory is Ayatollah Shobairi Zanjani, who is an expert in the field of Rajal. The field of Rajal is about the most outstanding transmitters of hadith during the history of Islam. He can enumerate for us the exact date of the birth and death of the transmitters along with their authenticity. Also, Ayatollah Shobairi Zanjani has exact information about the authentic resources and references of hadith studies. He and ulama like him has memories like a computer, and maybe faster than that. The most important reason for the sharp mind is concentration on fruitful materials and purity of the soul. As we read in the famous statement of Imam Ali alayhi salam, knowledge is the king.
Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hujjatul Islam Hosseini Qumi. To find out more about this program, log on to our website parstoday.com/en/Call of Islam page. We'll leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Gas supplies to Europe have tightened and fuel costs have soared since Russia's conflict with Ukraine in February and subsequent sanctions, leaving countries scrambling to refill storage and diversify supply channels. But despite the heavy costs incurred by their citizens, the Russophobia sentiment by many EU countries, especially those with close ties with the US, continues unabated. The Netherlands, Germany, Poland, and Italy are just some of the European countries who are buyers of Russian oil. But now the EU seems to have imposed sanctions on Moscow without having a plan for life without cheap Russian energy. A clear example of sanctions backfiring would be Germany, which recently reported its first trade deficit in 30 years. While the sanctions on Russia were meant to pressure Moscow in light of its special operation in Ukraine, the backfiring of the EU measures have given birth to disagreements between politicians and the bloc. The Hungarian Prime Minister has said that a failure in rolling back the sanctions on Russia risks the destruction of the European economy. Viktor Orban said European leaders should reconsider their strategy, as sanctions have caused widespread damage to the European economy without weakening Russia or bringing the months-long war closer to any resolution.
Absolutely. I think that the Hungarian leader, Viktor Orban, right now is saying what is meant to be unsaid and unspoken, is that basically the sanctions, this pressure campaign from the European Union against Russia because of Russia's special military operation in Ukraine is having a blowback, as the CIA used to put the term, in that the sanctions are actually working against the European economy. And what Orban was addressing was the fuel crisis that exists right now, compounded with the inflation that we see around the world. We're looking at fuel prices increasing, fuel shortages, and issues with fuel supply and logistics to get that fuel to the European market and to many of the nations. Remember that Hungary is landlocked, so it imports most of its oil via pipeline. And so right now we are witnessing a pretty catastrophic next few months and what some people are predicting to be a very tough winter for Europe.
In 2021, the EU imported around 155 billion cubic meters of natural gas from Russia. The bloc's proposed gas replacements by the end of 2022, which included LNG diversification, renewables, heating efficiency, pipeline diversification, biomethane, solar rooftops, and heat pumps, however, only amount to around 102 BCM annually. The European Commission and member states' efforts to diversify away from Russian fossil fuels were also clearly demonstrated in a memorandum of understanding with Egypt and Israel for LNG exports from the East Mediterranean. However, analysts predicted that there could be significant cost implications for Europe as it looks elsewhere for gas supplies. The International Monetary Fund even indicated that escalations to existing sanctions against Russia could cascade into even steeper energy price increases, deteriorating corporate and household sentiment and financial market disruption.
The European leaders don't really care about their people, and they don't really care about peace. They are interested in serving the military-industrial complex. They're interested, as members of the ruling class, in serving the lapdogs, you know, in Washington, in Brussels, in Vienna. And so they don't really care, ultimately, about peace and stability. Ukraine here is like a sacrificial lamb for the European leaders by which to pump in more weapons. Germany is rearming itself. NATO is going to increase its weapons. And we see, not only in Europe now, but everywhere, sanctions affect the poorest people. They affect the population. They don't as necessarily affect the leaders.
Spiraling inflation has been eating into the salaries of lower-income Europeans, and this has triggered protests and strikes across the continent over the rising cost of living. From railway workers to pilots, people from all walks of life dissatisfied with the situation have in one way or another expressed their concerns. Now, farmers in Spain have also joined the mass European protests seen in Italy, Poland, and the Netherlands. The farmers' protests seen in Spain, Poland, and Italy come after strikes in the Netherlands have led to many supermarkets running out of food as the anti-government movement continues. The rising cost of fuel has also been a contributing factor to the protests. Gas supplies to Europe have tightened and fuel costs have soared since Russia's conflict with Ukraine in February and subsequent sanctions, leaving countries scrambling to refill storage and diversify supply channels. But despite the heavy costs incurred by their citizens, the Russophobia sentiment by many EU countries, especially those with close ties with the US, continues unabated. The Netherlands, Germany, Poland, and Italy are just some of the European countries who are buyers of Russian oil. But now the EU seems to have imposed sanctions on Moscow without having a plan for life without cheap Russian energy. A clear example of sanctions backfiring would be Germany, which recently reported its first trade deficit in 30 years. While the sanctions on Russia were meant to pressure Moscow in light of its special operation in Ukraine, the backfiring of the EU measures have given birth to disagreements between politicians in the bloc. The Hungarian Prime Minister has said that a failure in rolling back the sanctions on Russia risks the destruction of the European economy. Viktor Orban said European leaders should reconsider their strategy, as sanctions have caused widespread damage to the European economy without weakening Russia or bringing the months-long war closer to any resolution.
Absolutely. I think that the Hungarian leader, Viktor Orban, right now is saying what is meant to be unsaid and unspoken, is that basically the sanctions, this pressure campaign from the European Union against Russia because of Russia's special military operation in Ukraine is having a blowback, as the CIA used to put the term, in that the sanctions are actually working against the European economy. And what Orban was addressing was the fuel crisis that exists right now, compounded with the inflation that we see around the world. We're looking at fuel prices increasing, fuel shortages, and issues with fuel supply and logistics to get that fuel to the European market and to many of the nations. Remember that Hungary is landlocked, so it imports most of its oil via pipeline. And so right now we are witnessing a pretty catastrophic next few months and what some people are predicting to be a very tough winter for Europe.
In 2021, the EU imported around 155 billion cubic meters of natural gas from Russia. The bloc's proposed gas replacements by the end of 2022, which included LNG diversification, renewables, heating efficiency, pipeline diversification, biomethane, solar rooftops, and heat pumps, however, only amount to around 102 BCM annually. The European Commission and member states' efforts to diversify away from Russian fossil fuels were also clearly demonstrated in a memorandum of understanding with Egypt and Israel for LNG exports from the East Mediterranean. However, analysts predicted that there could be significant cost implications for Europe as it looks elsewhere for gas supplies. The International Monetary Fund even indicated that escalations to existing sanctions against Russia could cascade into even steeper energy price increases, deteriorating corporate and household sentiment and financial market disruption.
The European leaders don't really care about their people, and they don't really care about peace. They are interested in serving the military-industrial complex. They're interested, as members of the ruling class, in serving the lapdogs, you know, in Washington, in Brussels, in Vienna. And so they don't really care, ultimately, about peace and stability. Ukraine here is like a sacrificial lamb for the European leaders by which to pump in more weapons. Germany is rearming itself. NATO is going to increase its weapons. And we see, not only in Europe now, but everywhere, sanctions affect the poorest people. They affect the population. They don't as necessarily affect the leaders.
Spiraling inflation has been eating into the salaries of lower-income Europeans, and this has triggered protests and strikes across the continent over the rising cost of living. From railway workers to pilots, people from all walks of life dissatisfied with the situation have in one way or another expressed their concerns. Now, farmers in Spain have also joined the mass European protests seen in Italy, Poland, and the Netherlands. The farmers' protests seen in Spain, Poland, and Italy come after strikes in the Netherlands have led to many supermarkets running out of food as the anti-government movement continues. The rising cost of fuel has also been a contributing factor to the protests.
U.S. President Joe Biden and Israeli Prime Minister Yair Lapid have reiterated their anti-Iran positions in a joint declaration. The two leaders signed this statement after holding a one-on-one meeting on Thursday morning in occupied territories, on the second day of Biden's four-day tour of West Asia. The statement says that the U.S. will use all elements of national power available to it to deny Iran the ability to arm itself with nuclear weapons. The joint declaration also includes a pledge by Washington to continue U.S. military aid to Israel. Hours after the announcement of the declaration, Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi warned of harsh and regrettable responses, saying any interventions of foreign powers in the region only results in crises and destabilization, while describing Iran's military power as a security factor. Observers believe that the unconditional support of the U.S. for Israel as the only regime that openly threatens Iran with military aggression can further embolden Tel Aviv.
I don't think that Biden's visit to the Middle East has really anything to do with arms sales. I think that essentially he's come first and foremost to try to get the Saudis to push up oil production to try to bring down prices at the gas pumps in the United States as Biden moves toward November 5th midterm elections for Congress and the Senate, where right now he's expected not to do too well. What I think this stems from is Israel's push to try to get the United States thinking somehow that they're going to intimidate Iran, which is ludicrous. That's not going to happen.
U.S. President's visit to the region comes as Washington and Israel have been pushing for an alliance of regional countries against Iran, the so-called Arab NATO. At the heart of such military alliance lies the perceived threat from Iran. Iranian officials have repeatedly denounced the destabilizing activities of Israel as the main source of insecurity in the region, warning regional countries of the perils of allowing the regime to establish a foothold in the region. Regional states and nations will not achieve stability and peace as long as the fake Israeli regime remains the first stop of U.S. President's trips, with the main target being to preserve the regime's security and dominance. The Islamic Republic of Iran considers the security of its neighbors as its own security. Despite the growing relations between Israel and the Persian Gulf countries amid gradual American withdrawal from the region, several observers consider the emergence of a genuine NATO-style alliance unlikely.
You understand how much more powerful Iran has become in the region precisely because of its alliance with China and Russia. And so if you look at the offshoot of this, is that any threat to Iran also becomes a threat to Russia. Now, Israel, people in Tel Aviv, they understand this. They understand it's been a shift in the balance of power in the region, and this frightens them. The reaction has been the attempt to build some sort of Middle East NATO, and that's not going to fly. It's not going to fly any more than the talk of European unity. That doesn't exist vis-a-vis Russia. It's just a contrived narrative.
A number of controversial questions are being posed by those analyzing Biden's visit and the so-called Arab NATO. The first question is whether the Arab states need such an alliance. Is the existing joint Arab defense framework so useless that it must be replaced by this new regional NATO? Second, the pact expects to be formed against Iran, but there are differing views on Iran's policies in the region. To include Israel, an occupier of Arab lands, in a new framework against Iran would only exacerbate the regional crises. In fact, a number of Arab officials have openly said in the past few days that their countries would not be a part of an alliance against Iran. And last but not least, not every country has normalized relations with Israel to form a common pact.
U.S. President Joe Biden touched down in West Asia. Meanwhile, it has emerged that his administration is considering lifting the ban on the sale of offensive weapons to Saudi Arabia. However, reports say the final decision over the issue is expected to hinge on whether Riyadh makes progress towards ending the war in neighboring Yemen.
This decision, supposedly hinging on whether or not Saudi Arabia makes sufficient political progress towards a negotiated solution with Yemen, as articulated, is in fact absurd. It's completely backwards. Rather than forcing the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia to the negotiating table, what it does instead is, of course, fortifies the lethality of the Saudi military, and it also, as well, gives it increased leverage at the bargaining table
According to media reports, senior Saudi officials pressed their U.S. counterparts to scrap a policy of selling only defensive arms to the Persian Gulf Kingdom in several meetings in Riyadh and Washington in recent months. In February 2021, Biden said he was ending support for Saudi Arabia's offensive operations in Yemen, a policy that included a ban on the sales of offensive weapons. But it was later revealed that U.S. contractors were still maintaining Saudi warplanes that were bombing Yemen. And the Biden administration approved the sale of air-to-air missiles to Saudi Arabia in November 2021.
Therefore, if the United States actually seeks to end the genocidal war against the people of Yemen, this decision to continue offensive arms sales such as precision-guided munitions to the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia is the exact opposite of what it should in fact be doing.
That's why one of Biden's main objectives will be to get Riyadh to increase cooperation with Israel. Although full normalization is not expected, Saudi Arabia could take a step in that direction by allowing Israeli flights in its airspace or by quietly increasing military cooperation to counter Iran. While in Israel, talk of military support for the regime was a priority for Biden. At home, any move to rescind restrictions on offensive weapons is sure to draw opposition in Congress, including from Biden's fellow Democrats and opposition Republicans who have been vocal critics of Saudi Arabia. However, the U.S. president is stuck between a rock and a hard place. If it does not yield to providing Saudi Arabia with more weapons, the kingdom may not have an appetite to reset relations with the U.S. at this point in time. Let's not forget, as a presidential candidate, Biden denounced Saudi Arabia as a pariah. Yet, Biden's approach has softened since the start of Ukraine war, which has prompted the United States and other Western countries to appeal to Saudi Arabia to pump more oil to offset the loss of Russian supplies.
Well, you know, due to U.S.-sponsored sanctions on some of the world's largest oil producers, Iran, Venezuela, and Russia, President Biden is facing a crisis that is largely of his own making and that of the United States. Therefore, he comes to the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia essentially as a supplicant with his hand outstretched to plead for increased oil production. President Biden, unfortunately, does not have any vision or plan for the Middle East.
The Saudi regime is considered one of the most despotic regimes in the West Asia region, which routinely violates the rights of dissidents. It has engaged in a brutal war against Yemen, which has killed thousands of people, including countless women and children.
So we can consider Sayyid Hadi Khosro Shahi.
Shahid Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr.
He was born in Kadhimiya.
The first and the most important thing that we can learn from Allama Tabatabai is his great effort.
In this regard, I should like to say that one of the great benefits of the late Ayatollah Sayyid Mahmoud Shahrudi was...
When we look at the works of late Rawzati, we see...
There is a famous sentence from Mirza Khalil Qamarani that he says in Farsi, "Tuhid kalame baraye kalame tuhid."
Be more familiar with outstanding Shia figures in the teacher.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page. This is The Teacher, an analysis on the thoughts and works of the most outstanding Muslim Shia scholars, dignitaries, and ulama all across the world of Islam. I'm Atta, the host of this program. Within this studio are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Sheikh Mahdavi and Dr. Fakhr Rouhani. Dr. Fakhr Rouhani, assalamu alaikum. Welcome to the show.
Assalamu alaikum.
And Sheikh Mahdavi, assalamu alaikum, brother.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah.
The personality with whom we are mainly concerned for today's discussion is a lady, we can say it's called a lady, Sayyid Nusrat Begum Amin, mainly known as Sayyid Nusrat Amin, a very outstanding dignitary, an outstanding arif, mufassir,
we can say, and faqiha among the ladies of the Shiite world. Shaykh Mahdawi, let's start with you, brother. Give us some details about the early life of Sayyida Nusrat Begum Amin.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Sayyida Nusrat Begum Amin is one of the religious women and also a scholar women of Shia, who is born in 1247, according to lunar calendar, in one of the cities of Isfahan. She is born to a rich family whose father was a merchant called Amin al-Tujjar, and also whose mother was a religious mother. And also he benefited from the great ulama. Actually, she started her study while she was 5 years old, yes, going to the Maktab Khane, before having these schools in their modern type. They would send their children, I mean the families would send their children to the place which is called Maktab Khane.
And usually in Maktab Khane, they were busy with learning Quran, Hadith, yes, and Arabic alphabetic or alphabets.
And also Farsi literature.
Farsi literature.
Yes, Farsi literature, okay. What right now we are missing in our generation. Yes, yes.
Okay.
So she started her study while she was 5 years old. And when she was almost 11 years old, she started officially to study religious lessons. And when she reaches 40 years, she gets the permission of ijtihad from the great ulama of her time.
Okay.
And very surprisingly, we have the name of the great and outstanding ulama from among those who got permission of riwayah from her. This is very... this is very strange.
I mean, she gave permission to the great ulama.
Yes,
like Allama Amini, Ayatollah Marashi Najafi.
Yes, these two are the most common that our listeners might be.
Was it common among the ladies to get the permission of ijtihad or hadith? Or, for example, about the religious studies, it is known. But about the high levels, advanced levels of studies, was it common something on that time or not?
To be honest, it was not that common, but it was not a kind of topic that you can marginalize and overlook it. Uh-huh. Because we have a books, voluminous book like Rayahin al-Sharia,
yes,
which has been written in regards to collection or categorization of the all scholars among the women.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's
and when we look at her name, we see this honorific title, Begum.
Yes, yes, yes.
Yes, which is given to the great women.
Yes,
yes.
That's right. The great, highest status women. That's all right. Okay, Latif Fakhwani, give us some details about the scholar life of Banu Amin. She's also known as Banu Amin or Banu Irani, okay?
Yeah.
These are the titles that are given to her, but mainly known as Sayyida Nusrat Amin, the Faqiha. Give us some details about her scholar life.
Yes, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim wa bin istain. It's an honor for me to be here in such a session devoted to a great lady.
Yes.
A great Shia lady who devoted her life to Islamic religious studies.
True.
First and foremost, I should like to say that a couple of years ago, I was lucky to find out one of the works of Banu Amin Isfahani.
Mm-hmm.
And when I started reading the book, I got surprised at the profundity of the discussions available in the book.
Oh.
It was about Shia history and Shia doctrinal topics.
Yes.
All in all, I should like to say that what's surprising in this regard is that Banu Amin Isfahani or Banu Nusrat Amin Isfahani,
yes,
I mean, she's got various designations.
Yes.
What's important is that she started learning Islamic studies and making a professional figure in this regard when it wasn't that common for ladies,
yes,
I mean for girls and ladies, to go to schools in order,
yes,
to learn something. However, contrary to the currents of the changes available at that time, and particularly in such a time that, because it was, in the time of Reza Khan,
yes,
and Reza Khan was, very much intent to close religious schools and to open, European-style schools.
Yes.
However, instead of attending European-like schools, Banu Amin Isfahani preferred to go to Islamic schools, and this is very surprising.
Okay? Yes.
At the same time, it must be indicated that One of the outstanding works of this great lady is Quran Exegesis,
yes,
in 15 volumes.
Yes.
And it was a kind of argumentative,
yes,
and, I mean, well-reasoned book,
yes,
and especially, I mean, packed with doctrinal and hadith-oriented discussions.
That's right.
It's called Makhzan al-Irfan.
Yes, yes, Makhzan al-Irfan.
Yeah, Makhzan al-Irfan.
Yes, that's right.
Another one is Al-Arab'in al-Hashimiyya fi sharh jumlatan min al-ahadith al-warda fi al-ulum al-diniyya. This book is about, Islamic studies, and it's about, as the title suggests, it's about, 40 hadiths selected,
yes,
from amongst the, a vast number of hadiths. Another one is, a book that she devoted to Imam Amir al-Mu'minin alayhi salam, Makhzan al-Li'ali,
yes,
Dar Fazilatin Mawla Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salam. This is, this book, shows that she was the real devotee of Imam Amir al-Mu'minin,
yes,
alayhi salam.
That's right.
The other books of hers are about, doctrinal topics or, generally speaking, Islamic moralities and,
that's
Islamic
right,
ethical topics and discussions.
But she's known with Makhzan al, we can say, Irfan.
Yes.
In Exegesis of the Holy Quran,
yes,
we'll get to that details. But the great point about her life is giving ijaza to, we can say, outstanding scholars like Ayatollah Marashi, Ayatollah Amini. Technically speaking, the fuqaha and the maraje, are they allowed to get permission from a lady in Islam or not? Is it so?
Yeah, nothing wrong with that.
Nothing
maybe
wrong with
we
that,
have but a kind of misunderstanding, uh-huh, regarding the position of ijtihad or marja'i taqlid to be given to a woman.
Uh-huh.
So what we have in the Sharia is that woman cannot assume the position of marja'i taqlid,
okay,
sitting at that position and giving and issuing the fatwa, and for some people to follow her,
mm-hmm,
as their marja'i taqlid. But reaching the level of ijtihad is something far different from becoming a marja'i taqlid.
Okay.
Someone might reach the level of ijtihad while she or he is not marja'i taqlid.
That's right.
So this misunderstanding maybe is coming from the propaganda against us that always Muslim women will be suppressed and their right will be taken away. But when we look at the position of Lady Banu Amin,
mm-hmm,
and the respect that she received from the great ulama, that we had some of the poetry in condolence on her demise by some of the great ulama, that being female,
yes,
for the Shams is,
oh,
not going to give any shortcoming.
Yes.
Because we know the word Shams in Arabic is treated as a female word.
Female one, that's right.
What we have, our listeners are familiar. In English also, we differentiate between he and she.
Yes.
There are some words that will be treated as masculine
and feminine. That's right.
Feminine. But in that poetry, that great alim is saying that being female is not giving any shortcoming,
yes,
to the Shams,
yes,
or to the sun. And also being male is not giving,
mm-hmm,
any advantage to the Qamar or the moon. And,
oh,
then he gets to the part of the,
right,
which is in concern with,
yes,
her position.
That's
and he's
right,
saying that while you are a woman, but you are standing at that high position,
level,
that many of the ulama got the permission of Rawaya and Ishrat from you.
Yes.
And she actually cultivated and brought up a,
yes,
lot of students.
Also, spiritual and mystically speaking, she has been the teacher and trainer of so many outstanding spiritual trainers. And this is also outstanding about Sayyidina Nusrat Amin. Murtaza Mutahari, Shahid Murtaza Mutahari, also says that when I was in her presence, I asked a simple question. And when she started answering, on that moment, I understood that what a great personality is she, how a scholar is she, to answer me with so much, power, can say, based on the knowledge. And this is really, we can say, outstanding about Sayyidina Nusrat Amin and the other ladies who are, as you said, by a wrong picture, which is given out of the, Islamic seminaries or something like that, that they do not welcome the women. The women and the scholar women are welcomed very much. As we said, socially and culturally speaking, she was very much active, especially in the case of hijab, isn't it? In the,
yes,
period of Reza Khan.
Yes.
What was the exact story, Dr. Fah?
Actually, as you know, in the time of Reza Khan, It must be first and foremost indicated that initially Reza Khan wasn't an educated person. He was an illiterate person.
Yes.
And based on authentic historical records available, it spoke that he was deliberately chosen for this purpose.
Yes.
Because an illiterate person is like a blind person. Okay, mm-hmm. Whatever you say to him, okay, he's supposed to obey. Okay?
Yes, okay.
And Reza Khan thought that, okay, opposing hijab or other Islamic rules would bring... for example, progress to the whole country, while it isn't the case, because, Islamic religion is never against, making progress in whatever field might be.
Yes, okay.
At that time, Reza Khan started opposing both, wearing hijab and the Goharshad Mosque in Mashhad, the episode over there, the massacre over committed over there is a good proof in this regard, first and foremost. Again, side by side with this, Reza Khan initiated, giving priority to Western-style schools in the nation.
Okay.
And it must be indicated that it wasn't the sagacity of Reza Khan to introduce Western-style schools because he was altogether against scholarship, against knowledge,
yes,
altogether.
Okay.
However, in order to oppose Reza Khan, various religious people adopted various policies. Mm-hmm. For example, the Iranian ulama who were in Najaf, okay, started attracting, some people from Iran and attracting them. They attracted them to Najaf in order to educate them as, clerics.
Yes.
Because Najaf was away from the, radius of Reza Khan's influence.
Yes. Okay.
But inside Iran, Banu Nasr Isfahani started, opening an Islamic school, an Islamic madrasa or college. Not that very much, widely famous,
yes.
But, she made school at home, okay. And, she started, admitting students and started, educating them. In this way, it must be indicated that amongst the top-ranking women, religious women who opposed Reza Khan, not politically or, for example, in a military mode, but rather in a cultural
aspect,
in a scholarly way, yes. Was Banu Nasr Isfahani. But at the same time, let me make a slight contribution. There's a book entitled Muhaddisat al-Shia. I think this book hasn't been translated into English, but I've read its Persian original.
Okay.
Muhaddisat al-Shia, it means the Shia ladies who transmitted hadith, generation by generation.
Or the female transmitters of hadith.
Yes,
right.
Female transmitters of hadith, yes. Written by Dr. Nahla Gharavi Naini, who is at the moment professor of Islamic studies at Harbi Modaris University in Tehran.
Okay.
If you refer to this book, if our audience refer to this book, they would find that throughout the Shia history, mm-hmm. right from the time of the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam up to now, there have been a large number of female transmitters of hadith,
okay.
And the most important transmitter of hadith, female transmitter of hadith, in the whole Islamic history, was Hazrat Fatima Zahra Salamullah Alayha.
That's all right. Yes. Okay, thank you very much.
Welcome.
But Banu Nasr Tamim composed an outstanding, voluminous exegesis of the Holy Quran, Makhsanul Irfan calls it, in fact, it's better to say the treasure of mystic or mysticism or something like that, Irfan. What is this book exactly? It must be very difficult, especially for a lady, yes. to, we can say, have an exegesis on the Holy Quran in 15 volumes and giving it argumentative analysis on the Holy Quran, isn't it, Sheikh Matavi?
Yes, it is really difficult, specifically if you consider that you are married and you are a woman, you are not a man. What we are familiar with is that women are working at home and they will provide some time for men to become great ulama.
Yes.
But now we are looking at this picture and we see a vice versa.
Okay.
Because she got married while she was 15 years old and she delivered 8 children.
Wow.
Out of which 7 died because of the diseases
the pandemics.
At that time. Yes.
Okay.
When we look at her lifestyle, we will understand that the achievement that she obtained was out of the grace of Allah and her hard working. For example, before we get into the topic of Mahsan al-Irfan, her outstanding work, we have to know that she was mostly staying at home and great ulama would come and teach her. So it is narrated that Sayyid Ali Najafabadi, who was her great ustad or teacher after the demise of two of her children, he didn't go to her house. He was thinking that she may not be concerned anymore with these things and lessons. But after 2 days, she sent someone after the teacher to come and teach me.
Yes.
And it shows her concern. And now we see such fruits out of her hard-working, like Mahsan al-Irfan, a voluminous book on the Quran. Actually, it's commentary on the Quran, as you mentioned, 15 volumes.
Yes.
And she mentions as her incentive or motive that pushed her to start writing this commentary on the Quran. Mm-hmm. She says that I was thinking, if possible, to collect a simple words of Ahlul Bayt regarding the Quran or commentary on the Quran. Then that thought and intention pushed me forward to start this work. And alhamdulillah, I succeeded.
Yes.
And I managed to have the entire completion of the commentary on Quran in 15 volumes. And when you look at the type of her commentary, you see, as Dr. Fakhr Rouhani, it's really well reasoned and has much to do with rationality.
That's all right.
Because of her hard working and
right.
Concentration on philosophy and
that's
mysticism.
Right. Yes, very good.
Alongside the riwayat and the hadith.
And you said writing an argumentative, you know, exists on the Holy Quran seems to be very much rational based, and this is something done by a Muslim Shia lady. We can say in the whole Islamic world, which made her an exception, I think, in the whole Shiite, we can say in the Muslim communities, especially in contemporary era. Thank you much, Sheikh Mahtavi and Dr. Fakhr Rouhani, for your presence in the program. The teacher talking about Sayyidah Nusrat Begum Amin, one of the most outstanding Shiite scholars and exegetes of the Holy Quran. She passed away on Sha'ban 30, 1403, according to the lunar Hijri calendar, in the city of Isfahan, and she was buried in Taht-e-Fulat Cemetery, which is the burial place of so many outstanding scholars and ulama of the Shiite world. This is really one of the precious grave sites of the whole Muslim land. So many outstanding scholars, ulamas, we can say from both sides, the ladies, men, and gentlemen are buried over there. And may our dear listeners find a chance to pay a visit to the city of Isfahan, its outstanding places, and also Taht-e-Fulat Cemetery. It was very kind of you, Dr. Fakhr and Sheikh Mahtavi.
Most
thank
welcome.
You. And thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program. The teacher, we talked about Sayyidah Nusrat Begum Amin, the author of Mahsan al-Irfan, Bil Tafsir al-Quran. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life pounding. IRIB English Radio.
تمام ارزش‌ها و صفاتی که انسان احترام می‌گذاره همه این ارزش‌ها در علی ابن ابی طالب جمعه.
Human in general, whether a Muslim, non-Muslim, or even a disbeliever, respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib.
لا يقيم أمر الله سبحانه إلا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
Imam Ali عليه الصلاة والسلام, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense,